Thank you very much. I would also like to thank the organizers for inviting me. Especially, I would like to thank them for keeping the invitation after seeing the title and abstract, because if you properly translate the title into the sort of language that you all understand at this point, I'm going to talk about estimating solutions of certain linear PDEs, which you might argue doesn't exactly fit the description of this workshop. So at least half of my talk is going to be spent on convincing you that this actually has to do something with all the words that show up in the title of the workshop: computational, combinatorial, and a lot of algebra. And so let's see. Maybe I say first something about the plan. So the plan is that we have four parts, of which part one and two will be sort of the introduction to what the title means. And three will be a bit of pictures. Actually, there are pictures in two as well. And then there will be a bunch of results, and I may have to cut that part a bit short, depending on how much time I have left. So before I tell you anything about GKZ systems, I want to tell you what hypogeometric is supposed to be. So if you take a power series in a single variable, then it's actually easy, and it is uniformly admitted that there's only one way of describing what hypogeometric means, and that is, well, it's generalizing geometric. So geometric is when the quotient of the coefficients is always the same number, right, in the power series. Now, the next generalization is that the quotient is a reasonable function in the index. And reasonable, in our case, means rational. So for example, if you look at the exponential function, then if you look at the quotient of two consecutive coefficients, depending on which way you go, you get either I or 1 over I. So that would be one very, very special case of a hypergeometric function. Okay? So this is stuff that has been studied for at least 200 years. And so Gauss was very interested in them. And then a bunch of other people of the 1800s were also very interested in them. And then the subject kind of died for a while. For several reasons. One is because they had other things to do, and one is because they sort of hit a wall when they were trying to say, what does hypergeometric actually mean in more than one variable? You can take several different approaches by sort of saying, for me, a hypergeometric function has the following property, and then see if you can do the same sort of thing in many dimensions. And the problem is that they all lead into different directions, and in some cases are not very compatible even. And one of the main things that people studied about hypergeometric functions was, well, if you have a function of this sort, so this is really saying that you have a recursion for the coefficients, right? I mean, in a sense, all you need is the first few of them, and then the rest you can sort of figure out. And that is telling you that these functions, they satisfy certain kinds of differential equations. And so the differential equations were studied for a while. In a single variable, that doesn't really lead to a very convincing sort of picture of what hypergeometric really means. Because you can have very similar looking differential equations, and they give you completely different sort of things. And it wasn't understood for a long time what it really was to a system of differential equations that would give you something hypergeometric. So that leads us to the first slide, which are these GKZ systems. So the break that people took from studying hypergeometric functions lasted until the mid to late 70s, when Gelfand and his school, and also Aomoto, became interested in them, mostly from the hyperplane arrangement point of view, but also for some other reasons. And then it took them another 10 years, the Gelfand people, to figure out what is a good definition. And here is the good definition. So in order to give you any kind of definition, I need to first tell you what this D is. So D is a Weyl algebra, which some of you know what it is, and some of you may not. So the idea is that you want to take a ring of polynomials, say, I guess I always take the complex numbers here, and you want to act on that ring. And you want to do that in nice ways that have to do with calculus. So things you can do to polynomials and hope to get polynomials at the end that have to do with calculus would be, for example, differentiating. Or you can take a fixed polynomial and use it as a multiplier on all the other ones. So that gives you two different types of operators on the ring of polynomials. And D is the ring generated by all these operators. So x1 up to xn are the operators which multiply by the respective variable. And d1 up to dn are the partial differentiation operators. And then we know that, you know, on polynomials and many other reasonable functions, the two partial operators to different variables commute, and so of course do the multiplication operators by the x's, but then the x commutes with its partial, not necessarily, only if the index is different. And if the index is the same, then you get a product rule which says that the commutator between those two things is 1. So you can think of D as a quotient of a free algebra in 2n things modulo these relations. Okay. So the ring D, or more specifically its modules, are much studied because they represent linear systems of PDEs with algebraic coefficients. That may take a while to settle. Maybe at the end of this talk you sort of believe that. So what I'm now going to do is I'm going to define one very specific type of module over this ring. In fact, it's going to be a cyclic module, so it's D divided by some ideal. So how do you make this ideal? It takes two ingredients. The first one is a discrete thing. It's an integer matrix. So it's D by N, let's say. And I'm implicitly assuming that the thing has full rank, first off. Secondly, that if you were to take the columns of the matrix and look at the subgroup of Z to the D that you get, it's supposed to be everything. And thirdly, I want to have that within, so I'm going to picture A always as its columns, as points in Z to the D. And I would like that in this space Z to the D, I can find a hyperplane so that all the columns of A are on one side, which I call point. Okay, so that's the discrete ingredient. And I'm going to let R be the polynomial ring in the partial operators. So this is a polynomial ring like all the other ones, just that we put an interpretation to it, which is somewhat unusual. And then from that, you can define the toric ideal, which you basically get by exponentiating linear relations between the columns of the matrix. So you take monomials delta to something minus delta something else, subject to the condition that the exponent vector on the left, when multiplied against A, gives you the same answer as the exponent vector on the right. And then as a quotient of my ring R modulo the toric ideal, I get a semigroup ring. It's the semigroup ring generated, or belonging to the semigroup generated by A, which sits naturally inside the Laurent polynomial ring in variables T1 up to TD. Now, the second ingredient that these hypergeometric systems use is a continuous variable. It's a parameter beta, which is in C to the D. And that I use by cranking out so-called Euler vector fields, and I have an example over here. So let's say my matrix A looks like this. Then first off, the toric ideal I get by taking the relations between the columns of this matrix. There's one, the middle one is the sum of the two other guys. That gives me exactly this binomial. It says that delta 1 to the 1, delta 3 to the 1 is delta 2 to the 1, because this and that is that. And then I define these Euler operators, and they come from the rows of my matrix, as is shown here. So this is probably quite clear how this happens. You decorate, let's say we take the first row, you decorate the first element you see with an x1, d1, the second with an x2, d2, and so on and so forth, and you add them all up. So this gives you some element in D. You do that with the second row, gives you some other element in D. Now that also is an element in D, and you throw them all together, call that the hypergeometric ideal corresponding to A and beta, and the quotient by that ideal you call the A hypergeometric system with parameter beta. So a good question is, why on earth would anyone want to look at this? And the answers are diverse and many. One is, if you ever want to do anything, or if you want to sort of play around with linear PDEs or systems thereof, these are the ones you want to start with because they have combinatorial structure. They're sort of like the toric varieties of the world of PDEs. Another reason is, the solutions of these systems come up in many places. They come up as generating functions for things that have to do with moduli spaces. They show up in symmetry, in mirror symmetry, because if you set things up right, then the Picard-Fuchs equations are contained in this ideal that you get. And also because every single hypergeometric function that the people of old knew about can be written as a solution to a hypergeometric, to an ahypergeometric system, if you pick the A and the beta correctly. So this is not always an easy thing to do. For example, if you take some Gauss hypergeometric functions, which are, you know, some stuff that Gauss was thinking about, it's not at all obvious what kind of number of variables you need in your ring and what A should be and what beta should be. But you can fit them all into this big scheme, which is why I think today, of all the different approaches to generalizing the word hypergeometric to many dimensions, the ahypergeometric approach seems to be the most successful. Okay, so that was the second part of the title. Now to explain the first, I may need a bit more time. So let's say you have a differential operator in a single variable, P, like this. So you order the elements that you see in there by the order of the differential, and you ask, what can you say about the solutions? And then we all know, you know, near most points what you get is a bundle. Well, what about the points where you don't get a bundle? So there things are messed up, and if you do things over the complex numbers, what you get is some kind of a singularity, meaning your solutions are in some way running off to infinity. So there are two types of these, regular and irregular. The regular ones are those where solutions grow, inverse polynomially at worst when you approach the singular point. So for example, if your operator is TDT plus 1, then the pretty much only solution to that is 1 over T. And that, as you approach 0, grows like an inverse polynomial. What? Well, that's what I said, pretty much the only. It's a one-dimensional space, I guess. Yeah. So the irregular ones, they don't have this polynomial growth. So for example, if you take the harmless looking operator t cubed dt plus 2, then again you have a pretty much unique solution, e to the 1 over t squared, and that is completely terrible near the origin. It has an essential singularity, and it is right. So one would like to classify when things are regular or irregular in, say, the origin. And more than 100 years ago, Fuchs came along and said, well, that's easy. What you want to do is the following. You want to look at this expansion of P by the powers of the partial. And you want to sort out, if you look at the difference between the index that gives you the order of the operator, that you look at, the part of the operator, and the order of vanishing at the point you're staring at, this is a critical number. And if this difference is maximized for the index that gives you the biggest order, which is to say, if pk of t times dt of k has the largest of these expressions, then the operator is regular. And in all other cases, it isn't. And this you can put into pictures. So with the two operators I mentioned before, I guess there should have been a plus one there. So you put things into something like a Newton diagram. Now, in a Newton diagram, you need sort of different degrees according which to measure you measure whatever quantity you want to measure. So here we have 2 degrees. The first is the F, which is by order. So any monomial is just valued according to the power of the partial. And then there is the V degree, which takes this difference that Fuchs said is the good thing to look at. And then according to these 2 degrees, you plot every monomial that you see in the operator. So you get this dot and this dot for t dt and 1, and you get this dot and that dot for 2 and t cubed dt. And then you take some kind of a convex hull to the lower left. And then the Fuchs criterion can be translated into saying that the operator is regular if and only if the uppermost thing that you find and the rightmost thing that you find in this convex hull have a point in common, which is then the upper right corner. So in this case, the upmost is this line piece here. The rightmost would be that, and they don't have a piece in common, so it's not regular. Another way of thinking of this condition is, well, if you already have this convex hull here, actually let's use this one this because it's not regular. So if you have this convex hull, so what does rightmost mean? Well, it means that if you were trying to do some optimization over this convex region, then this line segment here would be where this is optimized. Similarly, if you were trying to optimize in V direction, you would get this line segment. And from picture, it's obvious. You have something that's irregular if and only if, starting at, say, the V direction, you start tilting your degree into the F direction, you always stay at the same point as optimum. Because, you know, this is going to be optimal until you're sort of at this kind of slope, at which point you both get this point and that point, and then if you go even steeper, then you stay at this point until when you go at infinite slope, it's perpendicular. The perpendicular line segment is going to be the optimum. So, phrasing this into somewhat algebraic terms, we pick a weight vector where you know, the L here is some variable thing somewhere between 0 and infinity, and then whenever you do this, it's basically telling you you're going along some kind of a front that is between the horizontal and the vertical line. And then you define an L symbol, which is basically of all the terms in your operator P, you take the ones which have largest degree in that sense. Now, since T has degree minus 1 and DT has degree 1 plus something, you can show without too much trouble that if you compute the graded object of the ring D relative to this weight, you get something that's actually a polynomial ring in 2n variables. And the resulting symbol, according to this weight, defines something algebraic, defines a geometric quantity by saying whenever it vanishes, that's the quantity it defines. So if you do all this, then you realize you could say that a system is regular, even only if the L symbols generate for every L the same variety. Now, if it's not regular, at some point it will have to change, and that's what we call a slope. So in the example we have here that is not regular, what would the slope have to be? So if I gave, so let's see, so this term, which belongs to the plus 2, always has degree 0, right? Because it has neither t nor dt. On the other hand, the t cubed dt is always going to have 1 plus l and then minus 3. So it's going to have l minus 2 as a degree. And l minus 2 changes its size, I mean its whatever you want to call it. The bigger of 0 and l minus 2 changes exactly when l is 2, right? And when L is 2, that's also exactly this slope here. Well, this is a minus because I'm dyslexic and put the picture wrong way around. But basically, whatever slopes you find, they're exactly the slopes in the picture, just with a minus. And also, I guess I don't want to go back, but you remember perhaps that the t cubed dt plus 2 had as a solution a e to the 1 over t squared. So there's another 2 there, b over t squared, and that's the same 2 as the one that you find in this slope. So not only do the slopes, not only does the existence of slopes tell you whether a system is regular, but also the number that the slope is actually equal to tells you something about how fast the solution will run into the essential singularity. So slopes are a refined concept of irregularity because Fuchs is okay if there's no slope. Oh my god. Now in several variables, I guess I'm going to give this all at once. In several variables, you would like to generalize what it means to be a slope. And you run into several questions right away. The first is, if you have only one variable, then there's only points at which a solution can be singular. So what's the point? The point is basically, you know, where x is 0 or x is 17 or something like that. But if you have more than one variable around, then you can ask, well, can you be singular in a point? Can you be singular along a line? Can you be singular along a quadric? The answer is yes. You can be singular along anything. So what you need to do is sort of decide along what you want to test singularity, and I'm going to concentrate on coordinate spaces. So coordinate spaces are, they correspond to some of the x's being 0, so let's say k of them are 0, and then I want to define what does the v-filtration mean along such a subspace, and the answer is like before, you give the x's degree minus 1, you give the corresponding delta's degree 1. The order filtration stays the same as before. It gives every partial order 1, and it gives every x order 0. And then you make an L filtration by mixing them together, as shown here. And then, in analogy to before, what you want to do is, you want to study, once you have decided on what your V is, in other words, what is the subspace relative to which you study things, at what L does the variety of the associated graded ideal change? And again, as before, the way we pick things, Lx plus L delta bigger than 0 gives you that the graded is a polynomial ring, so this question makes actually sense. What is the variety of the symbol? Right, so I guess some of this I said already. The reason that you need to look at the variety is because the associated graded of a module is sort of an ambiguous thing. It's not intrinsic because it depends on how you pick the generators for the module, and then how do you give each generator a degree in your L filtration. So on the other hand, Laurent shows that if you look at the characteristic variety, which is simply the zero set or the support of the graded, that will not depend on, no matter how you write your module in terms of generators and relations. And in fact, he shows there's a more interesting thing than just the support. What you can do is you can define this characteristic cycle, which gives each component of the support a number, a multiplicity, so to speak, and that will also be independent of how you write M in terms of generators. And then Laurent said, one should say a slope is a number, so that the characteristic variety changes at that particular L. And what I would like to do is I would like to tell you a little bit of how one can use combinatorial and algebraic tools to predict slopes of the hypergeometric system corresponding to A and beta. And necessarily, this is really saying something about the associated graded of this hypergeometric system. Because after all, I'm telling you, I'm going to study the support of this graded object. So here's the example that is supposed to teach you everything. It's not quite the example I have over there, but it's sort of close. So if I want to study, okay, so remember that the hypergeometric system was the quotient of D by both the toric ideal and these Euler operators E minus beta. Now, if I want to grade these things relative to any weight one can think of, then somewhat optimistically you might think, well, you grade the top and then you grade the pieces at the bottom separately. Throw them together, mod them out, and that's the answer you get. So the thing is that these aren't the same, but it's kind of close. Because you know for sure that MA beta is a quotient of this GER here, and this and that will definitely be zero in it. The thing is, there might be combinations of the generators of the two separate ideals, which when you grade them, don't give you something in this sum. So if one understood this sum, one would then understand an upper bound for this thing. So in a sense, you know, so this is a quotient of that thing. So first I try to understand this, for which I first try to understand that. So in all actuality, I'm only looking at the toric ring for the beginning, which is the ring of polynomials in the partials modulo the toric ideal. And I'd like to know what are the minimal primes that I get when I L grade this thing. And L here can be any weight, positive, negative, zero, it doesn't matter. I guess if you want to, you can make them infinity, even if you put the right meaning to infinity. So this actually is completely geometric and works as follows. So in my example here, these three points, this one, that one, are the points of the matrix, the columns of the matrix A, right? And what I would like to look at in this example is an L that depends on the parameter T of this form. So, if you have any L, then it has, of course, as many components as you have variables. you can define new elements. Well, they're not necessarily going to be integer points anymore, but they will still be rational, at least if L was rational, which are the old column of A divided by the weight it is currently being given. And then this big delta, I call the AL umbrella. I'm sorry, the AL polygon, polytope, is the convex hull of zero and the scaled points that you get. And the set of faces that don't contain zero of this polytope is the AL umbrella. So in this case, it would be that segment and that segment. That's for L equal to 1. Now, let's have for T equal to 1. If T grows, well then, because this and the first and second entry are independent of T, that point and that point, they always stay where they are. They won't move. But this point is slowly moving toward the origin. And something interesting happens when the moving point hits the line that is connecting the two non-moving points. Because at that instant, the combinatorics of the AL umbrella is changing. It's not two line segments anymore. It's one line segment with a point on it. And one step further, it's actually one line segment without a point on it. So these are sort of interesting values of T. They're also interesting in terms of graded objects, as I can sort of demonstrate by example. So the toric ideal is d1 squared d2 squared minus d3, because taking this column twice and this column twice is the same as this column once. So if T is equal to 4, then d3 would have degree equal to T equal to 4, and that's exactly 2 and 2, which is the degree of the first term. So at T equal to 4, this is a homogeneous thing, and therefore its L symbol is itself, just interpreted in a different ring in the associated graded ring. Now, if T is less than 4, then because the first guy always has degree 4, the first guy is going to be the leading term, while if T is bigger than 4, the second guy is the leading term. If you make a primary decomposition of this guy and that guy, or actually if you just look at the minimal components, you realize that there is something that connects sort of the AL umbrella to the components. And that is, okay, this I skipped completely. It is generalizing an idea of Adolphson from 15 years ago. And it says the following. So I only want to tell you what the theorem says. It says, if you take a facet of the AL umbrella, so this is a facet of the convex hull of the scaled points and zero that does not contain zero and is top dimensional, then it will give you a minimal component of the graded ring, of the graded toric ring. And I'm going to call this the ideal corresponding to it, I call it I tau A. Now, how does I tau A come about? It's the sum of two things. One is all the variables that don't participate in the tau, so it's everybody else, and the toric ideal that you get if you look only at tau and never at A. So it's the ideal of binomial relations between the columns of tau. So it's toric. And I can tell you what's the multiplicity of this ideal in the graded ring that you get if you use LS grading. The multiplicity is the index of the group generated by tau in the group Z to the D. Okay. So the L umbrella tells you the combinatorics, at least some of it, of the graded toric ring. Okay, let me take some more stuff at once here. Maybe this. Okay, so now why is the toric variety called a toric variety? It's because there's a torus acting on it in a pretty nice way. So in my example over here, I have three variables in the space that the toric variety lives in, and there's a two torus acting on it because, in a sense, there are two rows. And how would the two torus want to act? Well, it would act separately on the three variables, labeling the columns. And for example, on the first column, it would act by first torus variable to the first power times second torus variable to the zeroth power times whatever the current x value is at that point. Second would be, you know, t1 to the 1 times t2 to the 1 times x2 and so on and so forth. That goes very well with a general picture because you can ask what are the orbits that you get in your toric variety with this torus action. And it turns out, so in the example, you get 4 orbits. One is the origin, because if you take the origin and act on it, no matter how hard you try, the origin will never move out of itself. So that will be the point where all the deltas are 0, called P, and that corresponds to the empty sets. And then you have another special class of points where only D1 is 0, but D2 and D3 are not. That corresponds to this kind of face. And so I guess you can't see the empty set, but you can see this one. And you can see this one. And then what is left, so to speak, is the big orbit, which corresponds to nobody is 0, which is the toric variety, take away this, this, and that. I'm sorry, this is... Darn it, I knew I screwed up. This is... It's somewhere written, right? Yeah. It's not on the toric variety. It's on the graded toric variety. So this is something that Adelson considered a long time ago, and probably other people. So I shouldn't have been saying toric variety the whole time, but graded toric ring. So for Adelson, he was only interested in the L that gives all variables the same degree. And that means you're actually looking at the picture that A represents itself, because nobody is scaled. So what he was saying is that basically the faces that you see right then correspond to components, and also that the facets correspond to components, and the faces correspond to nice sets sitting inside the components corresponding to faces. And this is all what I was trying to say here. So because the toric ideal is acted on by a torus, and because it's a binomial ideal, any of its lead ideals also has this action, and the orbits will then be indexed exactly by the umbrella, not just by the facets, but by everyone, as over there. And this I tau A, which I told you about, corresponds to an orbit which I call orbit indexed by tau. And inclusions of taus are preserved by the orbits. And then what does this E mean? So the point is that if you look at a torus, like, for example, at C star, then depending on the dimension of the torus, there are sort of standard vector fields on them, which are natural because they're invariant under the action of the torus on itself. So on C star, that would be just x ddx. If you play around with it, you find that ddx, which is the first thing you would write down, is not torus invariant. But then you find, okay, so the problem is because this has a scaling, and so you have to undo the scaling, you put an x in front of it. That makes it invariant. And as the toric variety is acting, as the torus is acting on the thing that corresponds to the graded toric ring, these natural vector fields on the torus are pushed forward onto that graded, onto the variety corresponding to the graded toric ideal, and they become exactly these EIs if you put them to the orbits. So there's nothing really random about why I would want to define the EIs. It's because they're the push forwards of very natural vector fields. And since the E operators, or the tangent fields, so since the E's represent the push forward of the tangent fields on the torus, they must necessarily span the tangent space at any point of the image. So this is saying that if you were to go and say, let's demand that all the E's are zero, that's exactly imposing a conormal condition to the orbits in the embedding in the ring that is indexed by the D1 through Dn. So each of the orbits then gives me a conormal, which I call C sub tau. So for example, let's say A is just 1. Right? So then there is no relation between the columns because you have only one column. So that means that the toric ideal itself is 0, and then it's graded as 0. On the other hand, E is x dx, because there's a 1 and nothing else. So the vanishing of x dx can happen in two ways, either x is 0 or d is 0. So if x is 0, well, that means you're standing in the origin, and because the origin is a point in a line, the conormal is going to be a line standing over that point. It's a one-dimensional, the codimension of the point in the line is 1, so therefore the conormal has to be dimension 1. So that's what happens if x is 0. On the other hand, if d is 0, well, that means basically that x is not 0 now, because we just looked at x is 0. So that means you're looking at every point that is not the origin in the complex line. Well, and there, of course, the conormal is, yourself, because you're looking at the conormal of something that is open in a space and that is locally just that thing cross nothing. Okay, so from now on, I want to put my knowledge about gradings of the toric ring together with these Euler operators to get something interesting about the hypergeometric ideal. And for that to work well, I need that, or I would like at least, I don't know if I need it, but I definitely would like that if I take an Euler operator and look at its L symbol, it doesn't change. So how could it change? Well, for example, if some of the XIDIs have bigger degree than others, that would be bad. So I rule that out and I say I want to have every time that I pick any index, I want to have that the L, the weight, the X weight is exactly 1 minus the D weight. So that makes all the E's homogeneous, so they don't disappear or change when I take this partially graded object. So then one can show, oops, that was funny. If you were to grade separately the Euler ideal and the toric ideal, and then throw them together, you would get components that are exactly these conormals C tau of the orbits. You would get nothing else, that's for sure. What's not quite clear from the beginning is that you get really all the C taus. I'm not claiming that. I just say, you get only C taus. So that says that if you look at the L-graded ideal given by IA and E minus beta together, because it's a quotient of this construct, the algebraic space that corresponds to it consists only of C taus and nothing else. Now, which C taus? So that's the part where it gets a bit sketchy. So what do these acronyms mean? Good filtrations, Euler-Kuzul homology, spectral sequences, and intersection theory. And that proves what? It proves the following. So C tau was one of these possible components of the hypergeometric L-graded system. Now, mu sub L sub C tau, I call the multiplicity that C tau actually has when I grade with weight L. Okay, and then I apply it to M A beta. So this is at least equal to the intersection multiplicity of the variety defined by the Euler operators and the graded ring of the toric variety when taken along c tau. So what does that mean? Well, if you take the variety defined by E and the variety defined by the graded toric ideal, and you intersect them, you get all sorts of components. And you might want to know, well, what's the multiplicity along this component or that or that? So since we already know that the components look like C taus, I pick one of them, and then it turns out the intersection multiplicity is a lower bound for the multiplicity of this C tau to show up in the L characteristic cycle. Okay. Then we have an explicit formula for it, which is explicit in the sense that you could sit down and work it out. The way you get it is, so tau is the thing that's fixed, and tau prime is a facet of our AL umbrella. And then because tau prime is a facet, this is a finite index here. You also look at what is the index of saturation of tau in tau prime. You multiply these two. And then you multiply with a funny thing, which I don't want to explain, but you can also work it out. It's just hard work, but purely combinatorial. Basically, so these two things, they arise by if you were to take the group generated by tau and take z to the d modulo that group. Now, the unfortunate thing is that that isn't actually going to be, that may have torsion. So you have to deal with the torsion somehow. Once you have dealt with the torsion, then you can look at, so you sort of get a projection from z to the d down to z to the d modulo the group generated by tau, and you can look at the image of the points that used to be A and now they're A modulo whatever that stuff is. So that gives you a new polytope of which you can take the volume, and you subtract it from the polytope that you got from all that stuff and the origin. Right. So one can show that this is actually a positive number. This thing here is not very difficult once you understand what the pieces actually mean. Now, if it's a positive number, it means that the multiplicity of C tau is actually at least 1, which means that it actually occurs. So this is saying that we know exactly what the characteristic variety, the L characteristic variety, looks like of the hypergeometric system. It's precisely a union of C taus, no less, no more. And if, this is sort of an appendix to this, if tau is itself maximal dimensional in the umbrella, then the sum sort of degenerates to this. So we can actually, and in addition, this becomes an equality. This also becomes an equality no matter what tau you took, if you took a generic beta. So there are some betas which are evil, for which most things fail. For example, one of the things that fails for evil betas is the following. You might ask, well, now that I have my hypergeometric system, how many solutions does it have? Well, because it's a linear system, it has a vector space of solutions, actually. And you can ask, well, what's the dimension? So it turns out they're always finite dimensional, and the number is precisely... if you do it right, it's the volume of this shaded area. So you take the columns of A and the origin, and you take the volume of the polytope that they span, the convex hull of them, the volume in the usual Euclidean sense, but you have to normalize it by some factorial, d factorial, I guess. And that's only true for good betas, not for evil betas. For evil betas, you can have more solutions. You do have more solutions. That is sort of the definition of what an evil beta is.
Can I ask you a question? So evil detection
term, what is the term good for? Determine evil beta? No. So at this point, the point was to determine what exactly does the L characteristic variety look like. So what I wanted to do was I wanted to study how do you get what does irregularity mean? In other words, what does having essential singularities mean for hypergeometric systems? As it turned out, this was the same as answering the question, how does L grading the hypergeometric ideal behave? This theorem says, what if the underlying space to the spectrum, or what if the annihilating, what is the support of the L-graded hypergeometric system? In other words, it doesn't tell you the precise algebraic structure, but it tells you what is the geometry of it. Because it says, the L-graded, the support of the L-graded hypergeometric ideal is the sum of all, is the union of all C taus, where tau runs through the faces of the AL umbrella. And it's very easy to say what that means for when it changes, because all you need to do is you need to check when does the AL umbrella change, which is something you can do on paper. It means, you know, you're pulling around your vertices on a sheet of paper, and whenever there is a critical thing happening, like suppose this A2 is marching in the direction of the origin, the instant it crosses this line, the AL umbrella changes, because it will have two segments at the beginning, but only one segment after the crossing. That means at this very instant, the collection of these C taus is changing, which means that the characteristic variety was changing, because the characteristic variety is sort of labeled, or the pieces of it are labeled by the C taus. Beta is the same all the time. L is changing. I'm always looking at the same system. So beta is fixed and A is fixed, but L is the quantity that's changing. And the graded that you get out of L will jump if and only if this combinatorial picture will change. So the characteristic variety is the union of all the C taus, and you get a slope if and only if phi changes, the umbrella changes at your specific L. So this gives you a few consequences. One is, a long time ago somebody proved, and it's now attributed to Hatta, but I'm not sure he was really the first, that if your matrix A is homogeneous in the usual sense, in other words, if the toric ideal you compute actually gives you a projective variety, then the A hypergeometric system is regular no matter what beta you use. So in other words, you will find no slope. In other words, these graded thingies are always the same. And that's sort of easy to believe, because like, what's an example of something that is projective? Well, let's say I take four points, no matter what the distance is, but let's say they're all on a line. Well, you can pull any of these you want. The convex hull, like, let's say you pull this guy in, the convex hull is never going to change, because it's always spanned by this guy and that guy and that guy. If this point is in here, it doesn't make any contribution to the convex hull, because you also include the origin. The only interesting thing you would say can happen when you have something that's a corner in some sense, and you move it through a line or a plane that is linking other points. So if you start with something which are all on the plane in the first place, then there's no hope of doing this. But people couldn't prove that the converse is true. And, well, now because we know that the characteristic variety is exactly encoded in this moving picture, we get a corollary that it's also true the other way around. If something is regular, it must be homogeneous. In particular, we get also a conjecture of Sturmfels. So he looked at all this and said, well, I conjecture that if you take this point and move it exactly on this line, then there's a slope there. And that's, you know, one of the things that we get. Yes, that's true, but moving a point inwards may create more than one slope, as for example this picture shows, because if you have three points, this one, that one, and this one, and you start moving the middle one to the origin, then at the beginning, your umbrella is going to be this piece and that piece, and then at some point it jumps when, you know, the point is exactly on the line between these two points, because then you have, well, from there on you sort of have three pictures of the umbrella, but then when it moves across this line again, you have two pieces again, but they're not the same two, of course, as you had at the beginning. So there are two changes of the umbrella, and therefore there are two slopes to this one hyperplane. So what this really means is that, let's say this is maybe index x2 here. It says that along x2, there will be solutions which, as they approach x2, will behave as if they had an essential singularity, but they can do it in two different ways. One is basically labeled or classified by this distance of that point from the origin, and one is labeled or indexed by the distance of this point from the origin. So they give you sort of the fastness of the essential singularity. And that's kind of it. So currently, we have sort of wrapped up the projective GKZ system stuff, which is an extension of what a GKZ system could be compactified to, and how to get slopes of that thing. And one thing we don't know at all is upper Sembi continuity, which means the following. So coming back to the number of solutions that an A-hypergeometric system has, I told you it's a finite dimensional vector space, and the dimension is usually equal to the volume that you get by drawing the matrix and then dividing by d factorial. But for some betas, this is the wrong answer. And one can prove that if you consider the function that sends beta to the volume of M, that sends beta to the rank of the solution space of MA beta, then this is upper semi-continuous in beta. So that means that as you move into a special point, it can only go up, but never down. So we believe that the same is true for the multiplicity along each of the C taus. So as you know, it turns out that this dimension of the solution space corresponds to when L is all ones and tau is the empty set. So certainly for one of them it's true that it's upper semi-continuous. We think it's true in general, but we don't know how to prove it, and the reason we don't know is because it involves, proving anything like it involves commuting two processes, at least it seems that it requires that. One is computing an L-graded object, which is to say a Gleipner basis, and the other is specializing parameters. And the sad fact is these don't commute. And that's why we don't know. In the special case for the solution of for the dimension of the solution space, you can circumvent the problem and do something entirely different within commutative algebra and therefore get the right answer. But for the general guys, we don't think you can do that, and so we don't. Thank you. Where it's reduced. So sort of by definition, the characteristic variety is reduced. You mean the L-graded ideal? They're sort of, let's see. Yeah, they're sort of stupid cases where they are reduced. So in this one here, So I don't think so. Whoever asked me. I think not. So the thing is, if you believe in this inequality, this one, then to say it's reduced, well, then you must require that all these are ones, right? So that means that all these are ones, and that happens almost never. So the kinds of examples you can construct are those where you have almost no variables, so that you have almost no taus, and then you can sort of cheat your way into ones, but it's not the kind of thing that typically happens.
Thank you again.